Pierre Bourdieu 1979 Classes and Classifications. Source, Distinctions, A Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste. Conclusion, 1984, translated by Richard Niess, published by Harvard University Press, 1984, 604 pages, selected from pages 466-484. Taste is an acquired disposition to differentiate and appreciate, as Kant says, in other words, to establish and mark differences by a process of distinction which is not, or not necessarily, a distinct knowledge, in Leibniz's sense, since it ensures recognition, in the ordinary sense of the object without implying knowledge of the distinctive features which define it. The schemes of the habitus, the primary forms of classification, owe their specific efficacy to the fact that they function below a level of consciousness and language, beyond the reach of introspective scrutiny or control by the will. Orienting practices practically, they embed what some would mistakenly call values in the most automatic gestures or the apparently most insignificant techniques of the body, ways of walking or blowing one's nose, ways of eating or talking, and engage the most fundamental principles of construction and evaluation of the social world, those which most directly express the division of labor between the classes, the age groups and the sexes, or the division of the work of domination in divisions between bodies and between relations to the body which borrow more features than one, as if to give them the appearances of naturalness, from the sexual division of labor and the division of sexual labor. Taste is a practical mastery of distributions which makes it possible to sense or intuit what is likely or unlikely to befall, and therefore to befit, an individual occupying a given position in social space. It functions as a sort of social orientation, a sense of one's place, guiding the occupants of a given place in social space towards the social positions adjusted to their properties, and towards the practices or goods which befit the occupants of that position. It implies a practical anticipation of what the social meaning and value of the chosen practice or thing will probably be, given their distribution in social space and the practical knowledge the other agents have of the correspondence between goods and groups. Thus, the social agents whom the sociologist classifies are producers not only of classifiable acts but also of acts of classification which are themselves classified. Knowledge of the social world has to take into account a practical knowledge of this world which pre-exists it and which it must not fail to include in its object, although, as a first stage, this knowledge has to be constituted against the partial and interested representations provided by practical knowledge. To speak of habitus is to include in the object the knowledge which the agents, who are part of the object, have of the object, and the contribution this knowledge makes to the reality of the object. But it is not only a matter of putting back into the real world that one is endeavoring to know, a knowledge of the real world that contributes to its reality, and also to the force it exerts. It means conferring on this knowledge a genuinely constitutive power, the very power it is denied when, in the name of an objectivist conception of objectivity, one makes common knowledge or theoretical knowledge a mere reflection of the real world. Those who suppose they are producing a materialist theory of knowledge when they make knowledge a passive recording and abandon the active aspect of knowledge to idealism, as Marx complains in the Theses on Feuerbach, forget that all knowledge, and in particular all knowledge of the social world, is an act of construction implementing schemes of thought and expression, and that between conditions of existence and practices or representations there intervenes the structuring activity of the agents who, far from reacting mechanically to mechanical stimulations, respond to the invitations or threats of a world whose meaning they have helped to produce. However, the principle of this structuring activity is not, as an intellectualist and anti-genetic idealism would have it, a system of universal forms and categories but a system of internalized, embodied schemes which, having been constituted in the course of collective history, are acquired in the course of individual history and function in their practical state, for practice, and not for the sake of pure knowledge. Embodied social structures. This means, in the first place, that social science, in constructing the social world, takes note of the fact that agents are, in their ordinary practice, the subjects of acts of construction of the social world, but also that it aims, among other things, to describe the social genesis of the principles of construction and seeks the basis of these principles in the social world. Breaking with the anti-genetic prejudice which often accompanies recognition of the active aspect of knowledge, it seeks in the objective distributions of properties, especially material ones, brought to light by censuses and surveys which all presuppose selection and classification, the basis of the systems of classification which agents apply to every sort of thing, not least to the distributions themselves. In contrast to what is sometimes called the cognitive approach, which, both in its ethnological form, structural anthropology, ethnoscience, ethnosemantics, ethnobotany etc., and in its sociological form, interactionism, ethnomethodology etc., ignores the question of the genesis of mental structures and classifications. Social science inquires into the relationship between the principles of division and the social divisions between the generations, the sexes, etc., on which they are based, and into the variations of the use made of these principles according to the position occupied in the distributions, questions which all require the use of statistics. The cognitive structures which social agents implement in their practical knowledge of the social world are internalized, embodied social structures. The practical knowledge of the social world that is presupposed by reasonable behavior within it implements classificatory schemes or forms of classification, mental structures or symbolic forms. Apart from their connotations, these expressions are virtually interchangeable. Historical schemes of perception and appreciation, which are the product of the objective division into classes, age groups, genders, social classes, and which function below the level of consciousness and discourse, being the product of the incorporation of the fundamental structures of a society, these principles of division are common to all the agents of the society and make possible the production of a common, meaningful world, a common sense world. All the agents in a given social formation share a set of basic perceptual schemes, which receive the beginnings of objectification in the pairs of antagonistic adjectives commonly used to classify and qualify persons or objects in the most varied areas of practice. The network of oppositions between high, sublime, elevated, pure and low, vulgar, low, modest, spiritual and material, fine, refined, elegant and coarse, heavy, fat, crude, brutal, light, subtle, lively, sharp, adroit and heavy, slow, thick, blunt, laborious, clumsy, free and forced, broad and narrow, or, in another dimension, between unique, rare, different, distinguished, exclusive, exceptional, singular, novel and common, ordinary, banal, commonplace, trivial, routine, brilliant, intelligent and dull, obscure, gray, mediocre, is the matrix of all the commonplaces which find such ready acceptance because behind them lies the whole social order. The network has its ultimate source in the opposition between the elite of the dominant and the mass of the dominated, a contingent, disorganized multiplicity, interchangeable and innumerable, existing only statistically. These mythic roots only have to be allowed to take their course in order to generate, at will, one or another of the tirelessly repeated themes of the eternal sociodicy, such as apocalyptic denunciations of all forms of leveling, trivialization, or massification, which identify the decline of societies with the decadence of bourgeois houses, i.e., a fall into the homogeneous, the undifferentiated, and betray an obsessive fear of number, of undifferentiated hordes indifferent to difference and constantly threatening to submerge the private spaces of bourgeois exclusiveness. The seemingly most formal oppositions within this social mythology always derive their ideological strength from the fact that they refer back, more or less discreetly, to the most fundamental oppositions within the social order, the opposition between the dominant and the dominated, which is inscribed in the division of labor, and the opposition, rooted in the division of the labor of domination, between two principles of domination, two powers, dominant and dominated, temporal and spiritual, material and intellectual, etc. It follows that the map of social space previously put forward can also be read as a strict table of the historically constituted and acquired categories which organize the idea of the social world in the minds of all the subjects belonging to that world and shaped by it. The same classificatory schemes, and the oppositions in which they are expressed, can function, by being specified, in fields organized around polar positions, whether in the field of the dominant class, organized around an opposition homologous to the opposition constituting the field of the social classes, or in the field of cultural production, which is itself organized around oppositions which reproduce the structure of the dominant class and are homologous to it, e.g., the opposition between bourgeois and avant-garde theater. So the fundamental opposition constantly supports second, third or nth rank oppositions, those which underlie the purest ethical or aesthetic judgments, with their high or low sentiments, their facile or difficult notions of beauty, their light or heavy styles, etc., while euphemizing itself to the point of misrecognizability. Thus, the opposition between the heavy and the light, which, in a number of its uses, especially scholastic ones, serves to distinguish popular or petit bourgeois taste from bourgeois taste, can be used by theater criticism aimed at the dominant fraction of the dominant class to express the relationship between intellectual theater, which is condemned for its laborious pretensions and oppressive didacticism, and bourgeois theater, which is praised for its tact and its art of skimming over surfaces. By contrast, intellectual criticism, by a simple inversion of values, expresses the relationship in a scarcely modified form of the same opposition, with lightness, identified with frivolity, being opposed to profundity. Similarly, It can be shown that the opposition between right and left, which, in its basic form, concerns the relationship between the dominant and the dominated, can also, by means of a first transformation, designate the relations between dominated fractions and dominant fractions within the dominant class. The words right and left then take on a meaning close to the meaning they have in expressions like right bank theater or left bank theater. With a further degree of derealization, it can even serve to distinguish two rival tendencies within an avant-garde artistic or literary group, and so on. It follows that, when considered in each of their uses, the pairs of qualifiers, the system of which constitutes the conceptual equipment of the judgment of taste, are extremely poor, almost indefinite, but, precisely for this reason, capable of eliciting or expressing the sense of the indefinable. Each particular use of one of these pairs only takes on its full meaning in relation to a universe of discourse that is different each time and usually implicit, since it is a question of the system of self-evidences and presuppositions that are taken for granted in the field in relation to which the speaker's strategies are defined. But each of the couples specified by usage has for undertones all the other uses it might have, because of the homologies between the fields which allow transfers from one field to another, and also all the other couples which are interchangeable with it, within a nuance or two, e.g., fine crude for light heavy, that is, in slightly different contexts. The fact that the semi-codified oppositions contained in ordinary language reappear, with very similar values, as the basis of the dominant vision of the social world, in all class-divided social formations, consider the tendency to see the people as the site of totally uncontrolled appetites and sexuality can be understood once one knows that, reduced to their formal structure, the same fundamental relationships, precisely those which express the major relations of order, high-low, strong-weak, etc., reappear in all class-divided societies, and the recurrence of the triadic structure studied by Georges Dumézil, which Georges Duby shows in the case of feudal society to be rooted in the social structures it legitimates, may well be, like the invariant oppositions in which the relationship of domination is expressed, simply a necessary outcome of the intersection of the two principles of division which are at work in all class-divided societies, the division between the dominant and the dominated, and the division between the different fractions competing for dominance in the name of different principles. Bellators, warriors and orators, scholars in feudal society, businessmen and intellectuals now. Knowledge without concepts. Thus, through the differentiated and differentiating conditionings associated with the different conditions of existence, through the exclusions and inclusions, unions, marriages, affairs, alliances, etc., and divisions, incompatibilities, separations, struggles, etc., which govern the social structure and the structuring force it exerts, through all the hierarchies and classifications inscribed in objects, especially cultural products, in institutions, for example, the educational system or simply in language, and through all the judgments, verdicts, gratings and warnings imposed by the institutions specially designed for this purpose, such as the family or the educational system, or constantly arising from the meetings and interactions of everyday life, the social order is progressively inscribed in people's minds. Social divisions become principles of division, organizing the image of the social world. Objective limits become a sense of limits, a practical anticipation of objective limits acquired by experience of objective limits, a sense of one's place which leads one to exclude oneself from the goods, persons, places and so forth from which one is excluded. The sense of limits implies forgetting the limits. One of the most important effects of the correspondence between real divisions and practical principles of division, between social structures and mental structures, is undoubtedly the fact that primary experience of the social world is that of doxa, an adherence to relations of order which, because they structure inseparably both the real world and the thought world, are accepted as self-evident. Primary perception of the social world, far from being a simple mechanical reflection, is always an act of cognition involving principles of construction that are external to the constructed object grasped in its immediacy, but at the same time it is an act of miscognition, implying the most absolute form of recognition of the social order. Dominated agents, who assess the value of their position and their characteristics by applying a system of schemes of perception and appreciation which is the embodiment of the objective laws whereby their value is objectively constituted, tend to attribute to themselves what the distribution attributes to them, refusing what they are refused, that is not for the likes of us, adjusting their expectations to their chances, defining themselves as the established order defines them, reproducing in their verdict on themselves the verdict the economy pronounces on them, in a word, condemning themselves to what is in any case their lot, to hew to, as Plato put it, consenting to be what they have to be, modest, humble, and obscure. Thus the conservation of the social order is decisively reinforced by what Durkheim called logical conformity, i.e., the orchestration of categories of perception of the social world, which, being adjusted to the divisions of the established order, and thereby to the interests of those who dominate it and common to all minds structured in accordance with those structures, present every appearance of objective necessity. The system of classificatory schemes is opposed to a taxonomy based on explicit and explicitly concerted principles in the same way that the dispositions constituting taste or ethos, which are dimensions of it, are opposed to aesthetics or ethics. The sense of social realities that is acquired in the confrontation with a particular form of social necessity is what makes it possible to act as if one knew the structure of the social world, one's place within it and the distances that need to be kept. The practical mastery of classification has nothing in common with the reflexive mastery that is required in order to construct a taxonomy that is simultaneously coherent and adequate to social reality. The practical science of positions in social space is the competence presupposed by the art of behaving comme il faut with persons and things that have and give class, smart or unsmart, finding the right distance, by a sort of practical calculation, neither too close, getting familiar nor too far, being distant, playing with objective distance by emphasizing it, being aloof, stand of fish, or symbolically denying it, being approachable, hobnobbing. It in no way implies the capacity to situate oneself explicitly in the classification, as so many surveys on social class ask people to do, still less to describe this classification in any systematic way and state its principles. The practical, attributive judgment whereby one puts someone in a class by speaking to him in a certain way, thereby putting oneself in a class at the same time, has nothing to do with an intellectual operation implying conscious reference to explicit indices and the implementation of classes produced by and for the concept. The same classificatory opposition, rich poor, young old etc., can be applied at any point in the distribution and reproduce its whole range within any of its segments. Common sense tells us that one is always richer or poorer than someone, superior or inferior to someone, more right-wing or left-wing than someone, but this does not entail an elementary relativism. It is not surprising that it is possible to fault the practical sense of social space which lies behind class attributive judgment. The sociologists who use their respondent self-contradictions as an argument for denying the existence of classes simply reveal that they understand nothing of how this sense works or of the artificial situation in which they are making it work. In fact, whether it is used to situate oneself in social space or to place others, the sense of social space, like every practical sense, always refers to the particular situation in which it has to orient practices. This explains, for example, the divergences between surveys of the representation of the classes in a small town, community studies, and surveys of class on a nationwide scale. But if, as has often been observed, respondents do not agree either on the number of divisions they make within the group in question, or on the limits of the strata and the criteria used to define them, this is not simply due to the fuzziness inherent in all practical logics. It is also because people's image of the classification is a function of their position within it. So nothing is further removed from an act of cognition, as conceived by the intellectualist tradition, than this sense of the social structure, which, as is so well put by the word taste, simultaneously, the faculty of perceiving flavors and the capacity to discern aesthetic values, is social necessity made second nature, turned into muscular patterns and bodily automatisms. Everything takes place as if the social conditionings linked to a social condition tended to inscribe the relation to the social world in a lasting, generalized relation to one's own body, a way of bearing one's body, presenting it to others, moving it, making space for it, which gives the body its social physiognomy. Bodily he/she's, a basic dimension of the sense of social orientation, is a practical way of experiencing and expressing one's own sense of social value. One's relationship to the social world into one's proper place in it is never more clearly expressed than in the space and time one feels entitled to take from others. More precisely, in the space one claims with one's body in physical space, through a bearing and gestures that are self-assured or reserved, expansive or constricted, presence or insignificance, and with one's speech in time, through the interaction time one appropriates and the self-assured or aggressive, careless or unconscious way one appropriates it. There is no better image of the logic of socialization, which treats the body as a memory jogger, than those complexes of gestures, postures and words, simple interjections or favorite clichés, which only have to be slipped into, like a theatrical costume, to awaken, by the evocative power of bodily mimesis, a universe of ready-made feelings and experiences. The elementary actions of bodily gymnastics, especially the specifically sexual, biologically pre-constructed aspect of it, charged with social meanings and values, function as the most basic of metaphors, capable of evoking a whole relationship to the world, lofty or submissive, expansive or narrow, and through it a whole world. The practical choices of the sense of social orientation no more presuppose a representation of the range of possibilities than does the choice of phonemes. These enacted choices imply no acts of choosing. The logocentrism and intellectualism of intellectuals, combined with the prejudice inherent in the science which takes as its object the psyche, the soul, the mind, consciousness, representations, not to mention the petty bourgeois pretension to the status of person, have prevented us from seeing that, as Leibniz has put it, we are automatons in three quarters of what we do, and that the ultimate values, as they are called, are never anything other than the primary, primitive dispositions of the body, visceral tastes and distastes, in which the group's most vital interests are embedded, the things on which one is prepared to stake one's own and other people's bodies. The sense of distinction, the discretio, discrimination which demands that certain things be brought together and others kept apart, which excludes all misalliances and all unnatural unions, i.e., all unions contrary to the common classification, to the diakrisis separation which is the basis of collective and individual identity, responds with visceral, murderous horror, absolute disgust, metaphysical fury, to everything which lies in Plato's hybrid zone, everything which passes understanding, that is, the embodied taxonomy, which, by challenging the principles of the incarnate social order, especially the socially constituted principles of the sexual division of labor and the division of sexual labor, violates the mental order, scandalously flouting common sense. Advantageous attributions. The basis of the pertinence principle, which is implemented in perceiving the social world and which defines all the characteristics of persons or things which can be perceived, and perceived as positively or negatively interesting, by all those who apply these schemes, another definition of common sense, is based on nothing other than the interest the individuals or groups in question have in recognizing a feature and in identifying the individual in question as a member of the set defined by that feature. Interest in the aspect observed is never completely independent of the advantage of observing it. This can be clearly seen in all the classifications built around a stigmatized feature which, like the everyday opposition between homosexuals and heterosexuals, isolate the interesting trait from all the rest, i.e., all other forms of sexuality, which remain indifferent and undifferentiated. It is even clear in all labeling judgments, which are in fact accusations, categories in the original Aristotelian sense, and which, like insults, only wish to know one of the properties constituting the social identity of an individual or group, eu justa, regarding, for example, the married homosexual or converted Jew as a closet queen or covert Jew, and thereby in a sense doubly Jewish or homosexual. The logic of the stigma reminds us that social identity is the stake in a struggle in which the stigmatized individual or group, and, more generally, any individual or group insofar as he or it is a potential object of categorization, can only retaliate against the partial perception which limits it to one of its characteristics by highlighting, in its self-definition, the best of its characteristics, and, more generally, by struggling to impose the taxonomy most favorable to its characteristics, or at least to give to the dominant taxonomy the content most flattering to what it has and what it is. Those who are surprised by the paradoxes that ordinary logic and language engender when they apply their divisions to continuous magnitudes forget the paradoxes inherent in treating language as a purely logical instrument and also forget the social situation in which such a relationship to language is possible. The contradictions or paradoxes to which ordinary language classifications lead do not derive, as all forms of positivism suppose, from some essential inadequacy of ordinary language, but from the fact that these sociological acts are not directed towards the pursuit of logical coherence and that, unlike philological, logical or linguistic uses of language, which ought really to be called scholastic, since they all presuppose school, i.e., leisure, distance from urgency and necessity, the absence of vital stakes, and the scholastic institution which in most social universes is the only institution capable of providing all these, they obey the logic of the party press, which, as in a courtroom, juxtaposes not logical judgments, subject to the sole criterion of coherence, but charges and defenses. Quite apart from all that is implied in the oppositions, which logicians and even linguists manage to forget, between the art of convincing and the art of persuading, it is clear that scholastic usage of language is to the orators, advocates or politicians' usage what the classificatory systems devised by the logician or statistician concerned with coherence and empirical adequacy are to the categorizations and categories of daily life. As the etymology suggests, the latter belong to the logic of the trial. Every real inquiry into the divisions of the social world has to analyze the interests associated with membership or non-membership, as is shown by the attention devoted to strategic, frontier groups such as the labor aristocracy, which hesitates between class struggle and class collaboration, or the cadres, a category of bureaucratic statistics, whose nominal, doubly negative unity conceals its real dispersion both from the interested parties and from their opponents and most observers. The laying down of boundaries between the classes is inspired by the strategic aim of counting in or being counted in, cataloging or annexing, when it is not the simple recording of a legally guaranteed state of the power relation between the classified groups. Leaving aside all cases in which the statutory imposition of an arbitrary boundary, such as a 30-kilo limit on baggage or the rule that a vehicle over 2 tons is a van, suffices to eliminate the difficulties that arise from the sophism of that heap of grain, boundaries, even the most formal-looking ones, such as those between age groups, do indeed freeze a particular state of social struggles, i.e., a given state of the distribution of advantages and obligations, such as the right to pensions or cheap fares, compulsory schooling or military service. And if we are amused by Alphonse Allais's story of the father who pulls the communication cord to stop the train at the very moment his child becomes 3 years old, and so needs a ticket to travel, it is because we immediately see the sociological absurdity of an imaginary variation which is as impeccably logical as those on which logicians base their beloved paradoxes. Here the limits are frontiers to be attacked or defended with all one's strength. And the classificatory systems which fix them are not so much means of knowledge as means of power, harnessed to social functions and overtly or covertly aimed at satisfying the interests of a group. Commonplaces and classificatory systems are thus the stake of struggles between the groups they characterize and counterpose, who fight over them while striving to turn them to their own advantage. Georges Duby shows how the model of the three orders, which fixed a state of the social structure and aimed to make it permanent by codifying it, was able to be used simultaneously and successively by antagonistic groups, first by the bishops, who had devised it, against the heretics, the monks and the knights, then by the aristocracy, against the bishops and the king, and finally by the king, who, by setting himself up as the absolute subject of the classifying operation, as a principle external and superior to the classes it generated, unlike the three orders, who were subjects but also objects, judges but also parties, assigned each group its place in the social order, and established himself as an unassailable vantage point. In the same way, it can be shown that the schemes and commonplaces which provide images of the different forms of domination, the opposition between the sexes and age groups, as well as the opposition between the generations, are similarly manipulated. The young can accept the definition that their elders offer them, take advantage of the temporary license they are allowed in many societies, youth must have its fling, do what is assigned to them, revel in the specific virtues of youth, virtue, virility, enthusiasm, and get on with their own business. Knightry for the science of the medieval aristocracy, love and violence for the youth of Renaissance Florence, and every form of regulated, ludic wildness, sport, rock, etc. for contemporary adolescents, in short, allow themselves to be kept in the state of youth, that is, irresponsibility, enjoying the freedom of irresponsible behavior in return for renouncing responsibility. In situations of specific crisis, when the order of successions is threatened, young people, refusing to remain consigned to youth, tend to consign the old to old age, wanting to take the responsibilities which define adults in the sense of socially complete persons. They must push the holders of responsibilities into that form of irresponsibility which defines old age, or rather retirement. The wisdom and prudence claimed by the elders then collapse into conservatism, archaism, or, quite simply, senile irresponsibility. The newcomers, who are likely to be also the biologically youngest, but who bring with them many other distinctive properties, stemming from changes in the social conditions of production of the producers, i.e., principally the family and the educational system, escape the more rapidly from youth irresponsibility, the readier they are to break with the irresponsible behavior assigned to them and, freeing themselves from the internalized limits, those which may make a 50-year-old feel too young reasonably to aspire to a position or an honor, do not hesitate to push forward, leapfrog, and take the escalator to precipitate their predecessor's fall into the past, the outdated, in short, social death. But they have no chance of winning the struggles over the limits which break out between the age groups when the sense of the limits is lost, unless they manage to impose a new definition of the socially complete person, including in it characteristics normally, i.e., in terms of the prevailing classificatory principle associated with youth, enthusiasm, energy and so on, or characteristics that can supplant the virtues normally associated with adulthood. In short, What individuals and groups invest in the particular meaning they give to common classificatory systems by the use they make of them is infinitely more than their interest in the usual sense of the term. It is their whole social being, everything which defines their own idea of themselves, the primordial, tacit contract whereby they define us as opposed to them, other people, and which is the basis of the exclusions, not for the likes of us and inclusions they perform among the characteristics produced by the common classificatory system. The fact that, in their relationship to the dominant classes, the dominated classes attribute to themselves strength in the sense of labor power and fighting strength, physical strength and also strength of character, courage, manliness, does not prevent the dominant groups from similarly conceiving the relationship in terms of the scheme strong-weak, but they reduce the strength which the dominated, or the young, or women ascribe to themselves to brute strength, passion and instinct, a blind, unpredictable force of nature, the unreasoning violence of desire, and they attribute to themselves spiritual and intellectual strength, a self-control that predisposes them to control others, a strength of soul or spirit which allows them to conceive their relationship to the dominated, the masses, women, the young, as that of the soul to the body, understanding to sensibility, culture to nature. The classification struggle. Principles of division, inextricably logical and sociological, function within and for the purposes of the struggle between social groups. In producing concepts, they produce groups, the very groups which produce the principles and the groups against which they are produced. What is at stake in the struggles about the meaning of the social world is power over the classificatory schemes and systems which are the basis of the representations of the groups and therefore of their mobilization and demobilization, the evocative power of an utterance which puts things in a different light, as happens, for example, when a single word, such as paternalism, changes the whole experience of a social relationship or which modifies the schemes of perception, shows something else, other properties, previously unnoticed or relegated to the background, such as common interests hitherto masked by ethnic or national differences, a separative power, a distinction, diachrisis, discretio, drawing discrete units out of indivisible continuity, difference out of the undifferentiated. Only in and through the struggle do the internalized limits become boundaries, barriers that have to be moved. And indeed, the system of classificatory schemes is constituted as an objectified, institutionalized system of classification only when it has ceased to function as a sense of limits, so that the guardians of the established order must enunciate, systematize and codify the principles of production of that order, both real and represented, so as to defend them against heresy. In short, they must constitute the doxa as orthodoxy. Official systems of classification, such as the theory of the three orders, do explicitly and systematically what the classificatory schemes did tacitly and practically. Attributes, in the sense of predicates, thereby become attributions, powers, capacities, privileges, prerogatives, attributed to the holder of a post, so that war is no longer what the warrior does, but the officium, the specific function, the raison d'etre, of the bellator. Classificatory discretio, like law, freezes a certain state of the power relations which it aims to fix forever by enunciating and codifying it. The classificatory system as a principle of logical and political division only exists and functions because it reproduces, in a transfigured form, in the symbolic logic of differential gaps, i.e., of discontinuity, the generally gradual and continuous differences which structure the established order, but it makes its own, that is, specifically symbolic, contribution to the maintenance of that order only because it has the specifically symbolic power to make people see and believe which is given by the imposition of mental structures. Systems of classification would not be such a decisive object of struggle if they did not contribute to the existence of classes by enhancing the efficacy of the objective mechanisms with the reinforcement supplied by representations structured in accordance with the classification. The imposition of a recognized name is an act of recognition of full social existence which transmutes the thing named. It no longer exists merely de facto, as a tolerated, illegal or illegitimate practice, but becomes a social function, i.e., a mandate, a mission, be rough, a task, a role, all words which express the difference between authorized activity, which is assigned to an individual or group by tacit or explicit delegation, and mere usurpation, which creates a state of affairs awaiting institutionalization. But the specific effect of collective representations, which, contrary to what the Durkheimian connotations might suggest, may be the product of the application of the same scheme of perception or a common system of classification while still being subject to antagonistic social uses, is most clearly seen when the word precedes the thing, As with voluntary associations that Ramanti recognized professions or corporate defense groups, such as the trade union of the cadres, which progressively imposed the representation of their existence and their unity, both on their own members and on other groups. A group's presence or absence in the official classification depends on its capacity to get itself recognized, to get itself noticed and admitted, and so to win a place in the social order. It thus escapes from the shadowy existence of the nameless crafts of which Emil Benveniste speaks, business and antiquity in the Middle Ages, or legitimate activities, such as those of the modern healer, formerly called an empiric, bone setter or prostitute. The fate of groups is bound up with the words that designate them. The power to impose recognition depends on the capacity to mobilize around a name, proletariat, working class, cadres, etc., to appropriate a common name and to commune in a proper name, and so to mobilize the union that makes them strong, around the unifying power of a word. In fact, the order of words never exactly reproduces the order of things. It is the relative independence of the structure of the system of classifying, classified words, within which the distinct value of each particular label is defined in relation to the structure of the distribution of capital, and more precisely, it is the time lag, partly resulting from the inertia inherent in classification systems as quasi-legal institutions sanctioning a state of a power relation between changes in jobs, linked to changes in the productive apparatus, and changes in titles, which creates the space for symbolic strategies aimed at exploiting the discrepancies between the nominal and the real, appropriating words so as to get the things they designate, or appropriating things while waiting to get the words that sanction them, exercising responsibilities without having entitlement to do so, in order to acquire the right to claim the legitimate titles, or, conversely, declining the material advantages associated with devalued titles so as to avoid losing the symbolic advantages bestowed by more prestigious labels or, at least, vaguer and more manipulable ones, donning the most flattering of the available insignia, verging on imposture if need be, like the potters who call themselves art craftsmen, or technicians who claim to be engineers, or inventing new labels, like physiotherapists, kinetherapeuts, who count on this new title to separate them from mere masseurs and bring them closer to doctors. All these strategies, like all processes of competition, a paper chase aimed at ensuring constant distinctive gaps, tend to produce a steady inflation of titles, restrained by the inertia of the institutionalized taxonomies, collective agreements, salary scales, etc., to which legal guarantees are attached. The negotiations between antagonistic interest groups, which arise from the establishment of collective agreements and which concern, inseparably, the tasks entailed by a given job, the properties required of its occupants, e.g., diplomas and the corresponding advantages, both material and symbolic, the name, are an institutionalized, theatrical version of the incessant struggles over the classifications which help to produce the classes, although these classifications are the product of the struggles between the classes and depend on the power relations between them, the reality of representation and the representation of reality. The classifying subjects who classify the properties and practices of others, or their own, are also classifiable objects which classify themselves in the eyes of others by appropriating practices and properties that are already classified as vulgar or distinguished, high or low, heavy or light, etc. In other words, in the last analysis, as popular or bourgeois according to their probable distribution between groups that are themselves classified. The most classifying and best classified of these properties are, of course, those which are overtly designated to function as signs of distinction or marks of infamy, stigmata, especially the names and titles expressing class membership whose intersection defines social identity at any given time, the name of a nation, a region, an ethnic group, a family name, the name of an occupation, an educational qualification, honorific titles and so on. Those who classify themselves or others by appropriating or classifying practices or properties that are classified and classifying cannot be unaware that, through distinctive objects or practices in which their powers are expressed and which, being appropriated by and appropriate to classes, classify those who appropriate them, they classify themselves in the eyes of other classifying, but also classifiable, subjects, endowed with classificatory schemes analogous to those which enable them more or less adequately to anticipate their own classification. Social subjects comprehend the social world which comprehends them. This means that they cannot be characterized simply in terms of material properties, starting with the body, which can be counted and measured like any other object in the physical world. In fact, each of these properties, be it the height or volume of the body or the extent of landed property, when perceived and appreciated in relation to other properties of the same class by agents equipped with socially constituted schemes of perception and appreciation, functions as a symbolic property. It is therefore necessary to move beyond the opposition between a social physics, which uses statistics in objectivist fashion to establish distributions in both the statistical and economic senses, quantified expressions of the differential appropriation of a finite quantity of social energy by a large number of competing individuals, identified through objective indicators, and a social semiology which seeks to decipher meanings and bring to light the cognitive operations whereby agents produce and decipher them, we have to refuse the dichotomy between, on the one hand, the aim of arriving at an objective reality independent of individual consciousnesses and wills, by breaking with common representations of the social world, Durkheim's pre-notions, and of uncovering laws, that is, significant, in the sense of non-random relationships between distributions, and, on the other hand, the aim of grasping, not reality, but agents' representations of it, which are the whole reality of the social world conceived as will and representation. In short, social science does not have to choose between that form of social physics, represented by Durkheim, who agrees with social semiology in acknowledging that one can only know reality by applying logical instruments of classification, and the idealist semiology which, undertaking to construct an account of accounts, as Harold Garfinkel puts it, can do no more than record the recordings of a social world which is ultimately no more than the product of mental, i.e., linguistic, structures. What we have to do is to bring into the science of scarcity, and of competition for scarce goods, the practical knowledge which the agents obtain for themselves by producing, on the basis of their experience of the distributions, itself dependent on their position in the distributions, divisions and classifications which are no less objective than those of the balance sheets of social physics. In other words, we have to move beyond the opposition between objectivist theories which identify the social classes, but also the sex or age classes, with discrete groups, simple countable populations separated by boundaries objectively drawn in reality, and subjectivist or marginalist theories which reduce the social order to a sort of collective classification obtained by aggregating the individual classifications or, more precisely, the individual strategies, classified and classifying, through which agents class themselves and others. One only has to bear in mind that goods are converted into distinctive signs, which may be signs of distinction but also of vulgarity, as soon as they are perceived relationally, to see that the representation which individuals and groups inevitably project through their practices and properties is an integral part of social reality. A class is defined as much by its being perceived as by its being, by its consumption, which need not be conspicuous in order to be symbolic, as much as by its position in the relations of production, even if it is true that the latter governs the former. The Berkeleyan, i.e., petit bourgeois, vision which reduces social being to perceived being, to seeming, and which, forgetting that there is no need to give theatrical performances representations in order to be the object of mental representations, reduces the social world to the sum of the mental representations which the various groups have of the theatrical performances put on by the other groups, has the virtue of insisting on the relative autonomy of the logic of symbolic representations with respect to the material determinants of socio-economic condition. The individual or collective classification struggles aimed at transforming the categories of perception and appreciation of the social world and, through this, the social world itself, are indeed a forgotten dimension of the class struggle. But one only has to realize that the classificatory schemes which underlie agents' practical relationship to their condition and the representation they have of it are themselves the product of that condition, in order to see the limits of this autonomy. Position in the classification struggle depends on position in the class structure, and social subjects, including intellectuals, who are not those best placed to grasp that which defines the limits of their thought of the social world, that is, the illusion of the absence of limits, are perhaps never less likely to transcend the limits of their minds than in the representation they have and give of their position, which defines those limits.